is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. These are difficult times, and talk of politics and policy are no doubt a common topic of conversation at many family dinner tables, maybe even yours. But put yourself at one particular dinner table in Cambridge, Massachusetts, over 20 years ago. Your father at this table is one of the few Republicans in the city, and he's also the United States Solicitor General for President Ronald Reagan. That man is Charles Freed, and you are his more liberal-minded son, Gregory. The dinner table debates are passionate, and beliefs are expressed with civility. Gregory Freed eventually became a philosophy professor at Suffolk University, but the conversations with his dad never ended. And after the events of September 11th, they focused on the lengths to which the United States government was willing to go to pursue intelligence and the laws it was willing to bend or even break to do so. Out of those conversations comes a new book, Because It Is Wrong: Torture, Privacy, and Presidential Power in the Age of Terror. And the Freeds join us now. Charles Freed, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's wonderful to be here. Having listened to it so often, to actually be here is great.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And I'd also like to welcome your son, Gregory Freed. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
Well, I have to say, in this book titled Because It Is Wrong, you take on three major issues which are very present in the mind of Americans these days: torture, privacy, and presidential power. But only on one of those issues, torture, do you come down with an absolute point of view, kind of an unyielding one. So what makes torture different than privacy and presidential power that makes it so black and white in terms of why it's wrong?
You know, the black and white part is really very interesting, because there may be shades of gray about whether something is torture or not. But what isn't in a gray zone, I think, is that if you're right there in the middle and it's clearly torture, then we have the argument that that just is something that no human being should do to another human being, no matter what. Now, no matter what type of arguments worry people.
Gregory Freed, in fact, you make that no matter what argument in almost religious terms, saying that torture is a violation of, quote, the image of God.
Right. And we use that image of the image of God cautiously to, I think, try to express an intuition, a moral intuition, that there is something sacred to the human person. Torture violates. And that especially in a system of government that is dedicated to inalienable rights, having that government violate that principle is a very dangerous precedent and sets up a relationship between those who are in power and those who are the subjects to that power, which is very unhealthy.
So there are those who make this argument of a ticking time bomb scenario. It's where authorities have a potential terrorist in their custody, and a bomb is set to go off somewhere, and the suspect is known to have, or at least suspected to have, information about that bomb. So these folks say that in that situation, torture is justified to save the lives of others.
These are largely fantasies that we come up with to test the limits of whether or not we think we would allow torture. It is almost inconceivable that we would know that we have exactly the right suspect with exactly the information that we need, and that he or she is just not giving that particular information at exactly the right time. How do we know that that suspect is the one? What magical formula have we been given that tells us that?
Although there are those who say in this day and age, preparing for what seems fantastical today is exactly what we should be doing.
Take it on another axis. Let's grant all the things that Greg raises. Let's just stipulate all that. People who say that under those circumstances, the torture would be all right, push them a little bit. Okay, how about torturing his 8-year-old son? Because this guy won't give up the information, but to see his son tortured, he would. How do you feel about that? And I don't know anybody who would go that far. And that just shows that there really is a line. which you just don't cross no matter what.
You know, one thing that I found very interesting in your book is that you actually relied on art and film and literature to really frame this conversation. The book is full of references to paintings by Caravaggio, as well as films such as The Battle of Algiers. But why is it that you went to that world rather than using concrete historical examples when it comes to talking about torture?
I think part of it has to do with our sense of what this book was trying to accomplish. It's not an academic book, although we are both academics. It was a book that we were writing for a general audience of fellow citizens, and we wanted to draw on a wide body of works in literature and art and film, as well as in philosophy, to allow people who don't come from academia to step into what we see as the core of the argument.
What does, say, referring to Caravaggio then allow you to do, for example?
This is Caravaggio's Flagellation of Christ in Naples, Capo di Monte. And you just see the brutality of the two torturers and the naked humanity of the person between them. And it's just very graphic, without being gruesome.
I think we didn't want to delve into a compendium of horrors to make
Absolutely.
Our argument. But the flagellation of Christ, and in fact the execution of Christ, used many of the methods that we think of now as torture. Christ was in many ways tortured to death. Crucifixion is in fact a form of stress position, after all. The pinioning of the arms leads to eventual suffocation of the victim. That's what causes death. And we know, as a matter of fact, that prisoners in U.S. custody have died as a result of what I would certainly call the torture that was inflicted on them, including sleep deprivation, exposure to extreme temperatures, and stress positions. And these were all authorized by our government. So there is a link between these historical acts and these historical images that we have of what is inexcusable in human conduct.
The second major issue that you deal with in the book is privacy, and that's specifically about eavesdropping and wiretapping and government use of wiretapping. So can you explain to me the connection between torture and eavesdropping and why you chose these two issues for your book?
These two issues were the two big things that came out of post-9/11 world.
And they're both about knowledge. They're both about the government's attempts to get at knowledge that it feels it desperately needs to do what it's supposed to do, to protect the citizens. And so that is why torture and eavesdropping have been so important after 9/11.
For torture, you make a very strong moral argument, but your take on privacy and eavesdropping seems to be a little more legal to me. And ultimately, if I read it correctly, you conclude that government eavesdropping outside of what is sanctioned by the law in certain circumstances can actually be okay.
Yeah, that's quite right.
So why?
That's quite right. Well, the privacy notion, unlike torture notion, is something that is itself in part a creature of law and custom. You know, in some societies, you go to the bathroom in public but eat in private. And in other societies, it's the opposite. Which one got it right? Well, neither one's got it right. But you look at the Constitution doesn't talk about you must never search or seizure. No unreasonable searches or seizures. We do say, we're really quite emphatic in saying, that there has to be some core of privacy. But what defines it is going to vary. And that's different from torture. And it's different from torture because torture has to do with the human body and pain. And that's sort of universal.
But Greg Fried, there are some, or many, I can hear them talking to their radios right now and say, that kind of cultural and historical relativism is exactly why we're seeing erosions in our privacy, our expectations of privacy today.
Right. And I think there's reason to be concerned about erosion of privacy. But I do agree with my father that the question of privacy is one that is open to adjudication by law. If there were an absolute privacy for human beings that could never be violated, I think it would be impossible for us to have communities with one another. We have to, as it were, step outside of ourselves to engage in politics, to know each other well enough to form a community. And we also commit crimes. And if there were no possibility of invading our privacy, we could not detect criminals.
Well, we're talking with Harvard Law professor and former U.S. Solicitor General Charles Fried and his son, Gregory Fried. He's the chairman of the philosophy department at Suffolk University, and they are both the co-authors of Because It Is Wrong, Torture, Privacy, and Presidential Power in the Age of Terror. Well, the last issue that you address is that of presidential power. Here, in this case, you do turn to history, specifically Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln, and when they knowingly abused their presidential power. So can you just walk us briefly through the Jefferson and Lincoln examples that you turn to?
In the early 19th century, when Thomas Jefferson was president, the United States was still a very young nation and still comparatively weak. The British Empire was very aggressive in stopping American shipping, searching the crews for British sailors who might have deserted from the British Navy. And the Americans were finding this more and more unacceptable. And there was an incident where a British ship called the Leopard stopped an American naval vessel, the Chesapeake, to search it. And the Chesapeake refused. The Leopard opened fire, crippled the American ship, came aboard, took off five sailors, and ended up hanging one of them. The American public was outraged. Jefferson thought that war was imminent, but the American Navy had something like five ships, and the British Navy was the most powerful in the world. And he realized the United States would be in terrible trouble if a war were to break out under these circumstances. And so he took money from the U.S. Treasury to equip the naval fortresses, to buy some more boats, to purchase munitions. But that was an unconstitutional act. Only Congress can raise funds for such purposes. He knew it was illegal, and he went to Congress after he had done it and said, "This is what I've done. Shoot me if you think I've done the wrong thing. But if you think I've done the right thing, please ratify it." And they did.
And the same thing happened with Lincoln at the start of the Civil War. He raised an army and paid for it. And the Constitution clearly says no money shall be paid out of the Treasury except by an act of Congress. Mm-hmm. He did that. What we're saying is, let's not obsess about law so much.
But Charles Fried, I have to ask you, without the law, what other bulwark do we have against the exact abuses of executive power of which you speak?
The law.
So we shouldn't obsess about the law, but that is what we have.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And the look of consternation on your face is entirely appropriate. Jefferson, Lincoln, even Bush on the surveillance, you know, he did go to Congress and he got it in 2007, I think.
For the expanded wiretapping.
Ratified. What they said is, okay, we thought we had to do this. If you agree with us, ratify it.
What I hear you saying is because they acknowledged the illegality of some of their acts after the fact and then got permission, that made it okay. So, but what's the difference between that and a criminal after the fact saying, "I know I did it, and it was wrong, and I'm sorry"? Our system of law isn't necessarily set up to forgive that and say it's okay.
The difference is that in the case of those political figures, the community understands that what they did was in the interests of the public good.
In what they believe to
right,
be in the interests.
But that's why my father's answer is the right one, is that the law ultimately will sanction those people if they believe they were acting in the public good, but the public disagreed with them. Public figures need to assume moral risk. If you go into public office as a president, you have to assume the risk that you will do things that you think are right, but that the public may require your prosecution for afterwards.
There's one idea in this book which is patentable, and it's Gregg's, I have to say, and that is, well, what if Congress won't ratify it? What do you do then? And then Gregg's patentable idea was, well, the president at that point should write up his own articles of impeachment and say, okay, if you think I did something that wrong and you won't make it right now, impeach me. Here are the articles. I dare you.
And should we live to see
that? That, I think, is just terrific.
Things like this do happen, though. In 2008, there was a woman in Boston. Her name was Jennifer Davis, and she went into labor in rush hour on Route 2 in Boston. And her husband drove her in the breakdown lane to get to the hospital. And he passed two state police officers. Each of them said, okay, go on, use the breakdown lane. They were breaking the law, but the police officers let them go by. The third state police officer stopped them and wrote them a ticket while she was in labor in the car because they were breaking the law. Now, which of the police officers do we think did the right thing? I would say it was the first ones.
You know, I take your point on this, but to me it feels a little bit like apples and oranges comparing officers writing tickets for women in labor driving in the breakdown lane and acts of presidents that have to do with war, that have to do with the suspension of civil rights, that have to do with how we live our lives every day. I mean, it sounds almost Nixonian to me, you know, this famous quote of saying, if the president does it, it's not illegal.
That's exactly the opposite of what we want to say. What we want to say is that the president has to take on, just like any officer of the law, has to take on the risk of sometimes breaking the law for a higher good and then asking to be excused for that. That's very different from saying that officers of the law are the law. But this is part of our argument in the book, and it goes back to an argument made 2,500 years ago by Aristotle, which is there is no such thing as a law that can possibly anticipate all of the conditions under which that law is going to operate.
Is what you're saying, can it be sort of boiled down to there are times where there are justifiable manipulations of the law, but it is incumbent upon us as a society who live by those laws to then modify them, to adjust them in accordance with what our values are at the time to say, yes, this is right, or no, this is wrong?
Yes, I think that's right. The surveillance is a perfect example. The scanning of cyberspace for patterns of speech or of messages to certain places after 9/11 violated FISA. FISA was a statute that was put in after Watergate when there wasn't an internet. And if they had waited to follow out those procedures, they would not have been able to get what is known as signals intelligence. That violation of FISA was ultimately ratified by Congress. Now, I think the reason it took so long to ratify it is because the attitude of the Bush White House was so provocatively extreme that Congress didn't really want to go along with it. They were just thumbing their nose at everybody.
And so, I think it's important to underline it's more than just casual thumbing of the nose. It was an ideological position that was held by the architects of what we might call the Bush Doctrine on presidential power. Mm-hmm. Their argument is that in his capacity as commander-in-chief, the president, when he is acting for the national security, simply cannot break a law. That is the equivalent of saying, I am the law. That's what we're arguing against.
Well, Charles Fried and Gregory Fried, I have to say that sitting here with both of you at our table feels very much like one of the most invigorating dinner table conversations anyone could have. And I understand that this book, Because It Is Wrong, was really born out of similar conversations the two of you had following September 11th. So has this kind of debate always existed in your family, or was it put into high gear following 9/11?
I think it's something that has a very solid tradition in our family. You know, my father was one of the few Republicans in Cambridge, Massachusetts when I was growing up. Yet he had friends that spanned the ideological spectrum, and it was quite normal for us to have dinner table conversations when I was very young with my sister and my mom and any guests that we might have about whatever issue it was of the day. People would take a strong position, but it was always quite ecumenical. The idea that you could argue a position, even if it was a passionate one, and yet remain cordial was a very important virtue that we held in our family. I imagine at times we violated it. But in writing this book together, I think we stuck to that very easily.
And in doing it together, in writing this book together, you seem to actually have accomplished something that is not necessarily waning in our society, but people are yearning for more of, and that is the synthesis of sometimes opposing views. You write at the beginning of the book, quote, that one of us, Charles Fried, had been a supporter first of John McCain and then of George W. Bush in the 2000 election. The other, Gregory, certainly was not. One of us supported the war in Iraq, the other only reluctantly. But the whole remainder of the book is actually written with a unity of voice.
Except for the very end.
Except for the very end, where you stake out, you plant your flags on your individual corners once again. What was the procedure of achieving a common ground?
I think we had been talking about these issues for years, since 9/11 itself. So I think we developed a pretty clear baseline of agreement on a number of the issues before my dad proposed that we write the book together. And for the most of it, until the end of the book, as you notice, we were able to come to agreement.
So then why is it that at the end of the book, in the last six pages, you go your separate ways and reestablish your individuality?
Well, it's just because we disagreed.
What exactly did you disagree on?
Greg thought that some of the Bush people ought to be prosecuted for the violation of the torture acts and so on. I thought that that would be quite counterproductive and we'd never get through it. It's the same instinct which led Gerry Ford to pardon Richard Nixon, and the same instinct which President Obama indicated that he's really not interested in pursuing this till the end of time.
And my concern is that even though Obama has discontinued the Bush administration practices on so-called harsh interrogation techniques, we have in place a precedent here, a precedent that is still being championed by the architects of that policy, Dick Cheney, his daughter Liz Cheney, and even President Bush himself have, since coming out of office, argued that what they have done was the right thing to do. And what that leaves us with is the precedent that another president in another administration will return to these practices. And so my feeling was, we need some kind of clear marker that this is unacceptable, and in our system of justice, that's what prosecution is for.
It's a pretty strong argument, isn't it?
And I think part of what we hope the spirit of the book would do is to encourage fellow citizens to take up these issues in a civil way. These are incredibly divisive questions. But I think the other thing that was compelling us to write the book is that this is also a decisive moment for our country, that if we don't speak in a civil way about these questions, we will find that in a generation, they have been decided for us in ways that we may not be happy with.
Well, Gregory Fried is chair of the philosophy department at Suffolk University, and his father, Charles Fried, is a professor at the Harvard Law School and former U.S. Solicitor General. They are both the authors of Because It Is Wrong: Torture, Privacy, and Presidential Power in the Age of Terror. Charles and Gregory Fried, it was an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, up next, something a little different, because love is blind, but maybe not when it comes to dating across racial lines in Boston. What do you think of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.